This is the weekend. In fact, Easter Sunday is the day when you will likely hear, or maybe you will initiate, that very famous phrase, "He is risen." And then someone will respond to you, "He is risen indeed." I hope you will take full advantage of this weekend to reinforce that reality and not let it slip away. He is risen. He is risen indeed. Well, I'm Pastor Rick Stevens, and I'm so glad you've joined us today on the program. We're going to talk about all things Easter related. We won't cover everything because it's an expansive, massive subject. But I just want you to know that Easter is the significant holiday for the Christian church, far more significant than Christmas, although we make more of Christmas in our culture. But Easter is so very significant because He is risen. Well, I'm the pastor of Diplomat Wesleyan Church in Cape Coral, Florida, and we will make much of Easter, not with all the bells and whistles necessarily, but with the focus on the reality that He is risen. I hear lots of people talk from time to time about this aspect of Christian faith or this part of the Bible, and is it true, and how do we know? And I have heard people say, well, this validates Christian faith or that validates Christian faith. But all of that is just what it is. What validates Christian faith, its reality, is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because He is risen, that validates everything He taught, everything He did, everything He is. It demonstrates that He is the one who rules and reigns, and He is the one who one day will make all the wrong things right, because resurrection validates Christian faith. No one ever in the history of the world has died, 3 days later, come back to life. It just hasn't happened. And the fact that Jesus did, that's what validates Christian faith. If you ever have doubts, wonder about this or about that, or is it true, or how do we know, always come back to resurrection. Because resurrection is true, because we can demonstrate its truthfulness, we have confidence that all that the Bible gives us, all that we know of Jesus, is validated, is true. And we can do what we need to do, stake our lives on it. And so we talk about this program being Faith Is, where we stretch in God's direction and where we understand that faith is absolute confidence in the trustworthiness of God. Well, that comes out of resurrection, because anyone who can come back from the dead like Jesus did validates His life and His teaching and everything about Him. He is risen. He is risen indeed. I had an interesting conversation a little more than a week ago, I guess now, with a young man. He was asking me a lot of questions, and that was fine. I enjoyed the conversation very much. And one of the questions kind of caught me by surprise. I suppose it shouldn't have, but it did. He kind of wanted to know why was it that I embraced Christian faith? In other words, why am I a Christian? And that kind of surprised me. I guess it shouldn't have. But I thought for a minute, and I simply said, well, it's true. The Christian story, the story of Jesus, is true. And if it's true, we need to believe it. And so that's why I really like to remind everybody at Easter that the resurrection validates all that you believe and all that you've known, because He lives and He is risen. He is risen indeed. That is what gives us certainty. That is what gives us confidence. There's nothing wrong with being confident and certain about the resurrection of Jesus. Every now and then, I read things that cause me a little heartburn when people seem to wonder about the certainty of the gospel or the Bible or anything. Well, I understand there are many things that we don't know fully. It's hard to understand everything fully. I get that. We don't have every bit of information we might like to have. But of one thing we can be certain: He is risen. He is risen indeed. And along with the celebration of Easter, I want to remind you, because I'm that naggy pastor in your head that says you need to find a church and you need to go every week. Well, this is the week for sure. If you don't go on Easter, when would you go? Well, maybe Christmas, but why wait till then? Some years ago, I had a good friend. He's now with the Lord, and he was quite the spontaneous and unusual kind of guy. Years ago, he was on the pastoral staff at a church in California. And at that time, I think he was responsible for the collegiate ministries, the way they organized their church. He had been the youth pastor for many years and then became the collegiate pastor. And that church had multiple services on Easter Sunday. And so the pastor, who was a wonderful guy, terrific guy, I met him time or two, didn't know him well, but knew about him and of him. And by all accounts, a wonderful guy. And he was kind of a little short guy. My friend was tall. He was taller, much taller than me. And one Easter, coming up to Easter, the pastor went to him and said, "Hey, I would like you to preach the middle service on Easter Sunday morning." Apparently, they divided up their responsibilities. And the pastor explained, "That's when most of the people from your ministry area come to church. And so I want you to preach that sermon on Easter Sunday morning." Well, as the story was told, my friend said to him, "No, I don't want to preach on Easter Sunday morning." Now, that was a little bit of a surprise because my friend loved to preach, and he was very effective at it. But he said to the pastor, "I don't want to preach on Easter Sunday morning." The pastor kind of was taken aback by that, and my friend went on to explain to him. He said, "I don't like those people. They only come on Easter and Christmas, and I don't want to preach to them. I don't like those people." Well, the pastor prevailed on him, and of course, he did agree to preach, and it may have been the last time he preached at that church on Easter Sunday. I don't know about the rest of the story, but you may understand why I say that. So he gets up to preach at the middle service. It was about the 10 o'clock service. I don't remember the exact time. But he gets up. It's time for him to preach. And he looks out across the congregation, and in a way that only he could do. He looked out across that crowd, and he surveyed all of them, and he said to them, "Merry Christmas." And he just stopped. And then he continued, "I just want to be the first to wish you a Merry Christmas, because I know I won't see some of you again until Christmas." What a way to begin an Easter Sunday sermon, eh? Wow, what a way. But that's what he did, and it didn't surprise me to hear that story, because that's the way my friend was. Well, after he finished that, the pastor met him in the hallway and got in his face. You know, my friend's real tall, the pastor's kind of on the short side, and got in his face and said, "Don't you ever do that again." Well, I understood, and my friend understood. My friend just looked at him and smiled and said, "Well, I told you I didn't like those people." And that was that. Well, I don't expect I'll ever do that. I might try to do it sometime for fun, but I could never be what my friend was or do what he did. And if you knew him, you knew he could say that in a way that was warm and friendly, but made his point as well. So let me make my point that you should go to church every Sunday, including this weekend, because it's Easter Sunday. And no matter what, you should be there. And you should find a church that respects the authority of the Bible, that will lead you in the way you should go, that will put you, as I've said and will say again, that will put you in the stream of grace and help you walk your way with Jesus all the way home. So, what are you waiting for? You don't even need to listen to me. It's fine, listen to me. Hang on, don't hang on, don't go away. But most important is you need to find a church that will help you get in and stay in the stream of grace. Well, enough about Easter. Let's talk Easter story a little bit. And where should we begin? Well, the Easter story is really a week-long story when you think about it, because it goes all the way back to Palm Sunday and the beginning of Holy Week. There are various events that unfold through the week, as the Bible explains them, including what we call the cleansing of the temple. One of the highlights of Holy Week, of course, is when Jesus gathered with his followers in the upper room to celebrate together that Passover meal, and how Jesus changed Passover forever and gave to us what we call the Lord's Supper or Holy Communion or Eucharist. He gave us that remembrance when we share the elements of his body and his blood that remind us of his death and we remember that until he comes. Then on Friday, we call it Good Friday. I know people think that's a little odd. It's good because without it, where would we be? We would be in big trouble. We'd be in huge trouble. We wouldn't have a chance. But because of the death of Jesus, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, we now have the hope of eternal life. We have forgiveness of sins, way forward in our future. Of course, Good Friday is followed by Holy Saturday, that time in between Good Friday, the death and burial of Jesus, and Sunday morning's resurrection of Jesus. And I often like to remind people, and I think it's helpful. You may not find it helpful, but here we go. I read some years ago, and it sticks with me to this day, that we live our lives on Holy Saturday. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that we live in the reality and the realization that resurrection took place, but the fulfillment of everything has not yet taken place. The Lord has not seen fit to return and to take care of all of the wrongs and make them right, and to take us to the new heaven that he is preparing for us, the holy city, the new Jerusalem. It goes by a lot of names. So we live kind of between the realization that it's going to happen and the actual living out that it's happened. So we live our lives on Holy Saturday. Well, that's not a bad thing. It gives us perspective. And then, of course, we come to Easter Sunday, the discovery that Jesus was alive and all that that means to us. And it's difficult, almost impossible to put what that means into words. We try. We'll revisit that today. But it is difficult. There's no question about it, because it is so life-changing. It changes the world. Whether people recognize the reality of Jesus' life, his death, his burial, and resurrection, or whether they deny it, there's no doubt that his life, his death, his burial, his resurrection changed the world. So let's pick up the story and make some observations about it as we revisit things. The story of the events of Good Friday and then Easter Sunday. Well, on Good Friday, and we touched on this already, but I want to revisit it because I think it's so important for us to realize. On Good Friday, Jesus was crucified. He got to crucifixion because he gave himself up to those who came to arrest him. So following the meal that they celebrated together, following the Passover meal that they celebrated somewhere in Jerusalem, he and his disciples left that upper room. They traveled through the city, went down and across the Kidron Valley and up the Mount of Olives to a place called Gethsemane. Gethsemane is kind of an unusual word, but it really is identifying an olive press area, literally meaning place of the press. And so they went to this olive press. They'd been there before, likely. Near as we can tell, it wasn't an unfamiliar place to them. But they got out of the city and away from all of the things and gathered there in Gethsemane. Then Jesus took three of his disciples. He went a little farther into the olive grove, which when you go there and you see it, you understand that he went a little farther south on the side of the Mount of Olives, deeper into the olive grove, where he left those three to pray and to watch with him. And then he went a little farther by himself, a little farther south into that olive grove. And as I like to point out, and as it remains stunning to me, Jesus, when he went farther south from the place of the press to the first place where he left the three disciples, and then went farther south still, he was going ever closer to the road that would take him to Bethany. Now, Bethany is where he had friends, where he could have gone. And because of the geography and because of his, distance to that road, he could have left the Mount of Olives. He could have left that olive grove, slipped onto the road to Bethany, and been gone, and nobody would have known. And that's literally true. That is geographically defensible. That's what you discover when you go there. He could have gone to Bethany with his friends. He could have gone into the wilderness and escaped. He could have gone where no one could have found him. It would have been that simple. But instead, he retraced his steps, went back to where he left the other three disciples, and then they went back to where the other disciples were waiting there at the place of the press. And about that time, as the Bible tells the story, those people, those men who came to arrest him, were there, and he greeted them and gave himself up to be arrested. And then, of course, they took him to trial and to the execution by crucifixion. I think it's absolutely essential that we realize that Jesus deliberately walked into that when he could have just as easily walked away from it. That's stunning. We should not let that slip away without acknowledging it, without recognizing that this is the seriousness with which Jesus took this, that he walked from the far end of that olive grove back to where those men were coming and said, "You're looking for me? Here I am." And they took him away to death by crucifixion. Just stunning. Well, along that line, people will sometimes then ask the question, well, why did Jesus have to die? I mean, if he could have easily escaped, why didn't he? Why was it necessary for Jesus to die? And I think that's a good question. And you will often hear a lot of explanations for it, most of which don't really help me much. The one I like least is the kind of accusation that this was a terrible thing that God did to his son, that he took out his wrath on Jesus. He was so angry at people or sin or something that he just took it all out on Jesus. Well, I understand the Bible uses wrath imagery and some of that, but I don't think it's helpful to see God as vengeful in that way. God's not vengeful toward people or toward Jesus. God is absolutely, absolutely against evil and will take steps to crush evil. We know that from all the way back in the Garden of Eden, from all the way back to that first encounter with the tempter. We often equate with the serpent, the snake. And he said that you will be crushed one day. And that was God's clear statement of judgment on evil. So it's not any surprise that God is so against evil. He doesn't like evil because it's bad for us. It harms his creation. It damages and destroys people. And so God is really, really determined to get rid of evil. But that doesn't really equate to God taking out his wrath on Jesus. That's just simply not a helpful way to look at it. So what is a helpful way to look at it? Well, what helps me, and so maybe it'll help you, I hope so, what helps me is to remember that the fulfillment of the coming of Jesus, his death, burial, and resurrection specifically, is a continuation of God revealing himself through what the Bible calls covenant, and what they understood in ancient times as a significant establishment of relationship between two parties, usually between two tribal chiefs, or we might think of them as heads of households. Well, God, in Genesis chapter 15, approached Abraham, then known as Abram. His name was changed when he became God's covenant partner. God, as some people like to explain, I think they're really onto something, changed his main name to insert the name of God in Abraham. And the name of God was unpronounceable in those days, the way they handled it, because they were reverencing the name of God. And so Abram became Abraham, and that Ham part becomes the name of God that's now associated with Abraham because they are covenant partners. Well, it starts out by God approaching Abraham and asking him to be his covenant partner. This is stunning. Of all of the people that God could have approached, he chose Abraham. And he approached Abraham, and they had a conversation, a pretty frank conversation. You can read about it in Genesis chapter 15. Abram at the time, was very frank with God about his situation. He didn't have an heir. And so God coming along and making promises to him didn't quite add up to Abram, because you can make promises to me and about my offspring and about my family heritage and all that, but I don't have a son, so how am I going to have a family heritage and all of that that goes with it? Well, God said to Abram, he said, don't worry about that, I'll take care of that. You'll have descendants. You'll have more descendants than the stars in the sky, if you care to count them. Well, that's a pretty strong statement for a guy that doesn't have a son to hear. I mean, he's hearing God say that, and what's he do with that? Well, there's a very simple statement that's made in Genesis chapter 15, verse 6. And he, referring to Abraham, he, Abram, believed the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness. So in order to begin this idea of cutting covenant, and that really is the way the ancient language describes it, cutting covenant, because it involved cutting the bodies of animals. It was a blood covenant, serious implications. And all Abram had to do was to believe the Lord. Now, sometimes we miss the idea or the full intent of that believe. Believe, as we need to think about it, and as Abram thought about it, was full allegiance to God. It wasn't just believing there was a God. Lots of people believe there is a God, and they want to tell us they believe in God, but not so many people want to give full allegiance to God so that God comes first. And that's sort of what we challenge ourselves with here, is to put God first, to stretch in God's direction, to have absolute confidence in his trustworthiness. And that's what Abram expressed there when it says that Abram believed God, and God credited to Abram as righteousness. So that's what God wanted to hear from Abram. Abram's commitment to be God's covenant partner. Well, that's the beginning of a covenant ceremony. And the ceremony unfolds, and we watch how it unfolds as chapter 15 goes on. It's really interesting. We don't have all of the details. We have enough details that it helps us understand. Ancient people would have easily filled in the blanks because they understood this whole idea of covenant and having covenant-cutting ceremonies. But Abram goes and gets animals at God's instructions, and then he sacrifices those animals and cuts them and lays the halves open, kind of in a row. That was part of the ceremony that was significant, because a blood covenant ceremony had specific commitments that the partners made to each other. And they were responsible to keep those promises. And the penalty for failing to keep those promises is death. Now you and I might say, whoa, what's going on? You mean they did. And yeah, that's what God is inviting Abram into, to this kind of covenant relationship that says, I'm making these promises to you, and you're making promises to me, and the penalty for either of us breaking these promises is death. That's what two covenant partners would do. And so Abram does the work to get this sacrifice ready. I guess sacrifice is a good way to say it. These animals that were part of the covenant ceremony, and he lays them out. And then God does something very unusual. Usually in a covenant ceremony, both partners are active participants because they make these promises to each other. Two tribal chieftains will make these pledges to each other. But here they get to the point of walking through these carcasses, which is a significant part of the ceremony, and pledging themselves to keep their covenant promises, to be faithful to the commitment they're making. They would walk down through these and make those pledges. So it's all ready to do that. And God says to Abram, go sit over there, Abram, and don't get involved. And God puts Abram over on the shelf, as it were, and into a kind of conscious coma. Well, we'll pick up what's really going on here in just a minute, but we need to take a break. So take a breath, and we'll be right back. I'm Pastor Rick. Stay with us on Faith Is.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/outloud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Be a part of a revolutionary new healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interests of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death and disability. Today's high-stress, on-the-go lifestyle makes it hard to stay heart healthy. Lifestyle changes like exercise and diet are critical, but you can also support your heart with concentrated nutrients. Healthy Cell created Heart and Vascular Health to support three aspects of heart health: cholesterol, blood pressure, and triglycerides, with CoQ10, vitamin K2, resveratrol, and soluble fiber. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. You would need to take 13 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great-tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. Get heart healthy. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
Spike proteins help viruses enter into your cells, disrupting your health and your well-being. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body of spike proteins, which allows your body to repair from within, supporting your immune and respiratory systems and regulating your inflammatory response. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
ASEA believes that inside each of us is the potential to feel our very best. Our customers will tell you how our products have made a difference for them, from improving immune health and supporting gut health to reducing the appearance of wrinkles and even improving mind, mood, and energy. Make our breakthrough products an essential step in fulfilling your greatest potential. ASEA. We power potential. For exclusive savings, use code OUTLOUD to save 15% off your first order today.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years. Brush, floss, repeat. We're told to use fluoride, which doesn't really address the acid-creating bacteria. That is where the dentist-recommended Spry Dental Defense System shines. Spry products contain xylitol, a natural sugar which helps get rid of those nasty, smelly, acid-creating bacteria in our mouth. The best way to care for your teeth and gums is by using Spry. The Spry Dental Defense System has a wide variety of products, toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and chewing gums that are designed to work together to keep your teeth clean and mouth healthy and smelling sweet all day long. To get your oral care back on track in an easy, effective, and very tasty way, switch to Spry today. Ask your dentist about xylitol and the Spry products. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural product retailers.
Well, the year 2024 must be the year of the Patriot, and AmericaOutloud.news will equip you with all the information you need to give new meaning to the words Patriot Act. For our actions always ultimately define our words. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back. You're listening to Faith Is, and I'm Pastor Rick Stevens. I'm the pastor at Diplomat Wesleyan Church in Cape Coral, Florida. And we have been talking all things resurrection and Easter. Well, maybe not all things. It's impossible to talk about all things, but a bunch of those kind of things. We reminded ourselves that He is risen. He is risen indeed. And we reminded ourselves that because of the resurrection, because Jesus is alive, that validates Christian faith. We don't really need anything else to point to of why we should believe or why we do believe. He is risen. That's enough to demonstrate the truthfulness of the Christian faith or of the Bible, that Jesus is alive. And so we depend upon that. We celebrate that. And we've been talking about some of the events that led up to Easter Sunday. And we were talking about, when we took a little break there, we were talking about Good Friday and exploring the reason that Jesus had to die. A lot of people struggle with that. And truthfully, that's a good question to think through. And so we're thinking it through in terms of covenant. And we went all the way back to Genesis 15, where God approached Abram and invited him into a covenant relationship. And this is what, to me, helps me most in explaining why Jesus had to die. So Abram got the animals, got them all prepared. They were sacrificed. They got to the point of the ceremony where the two covenant partners would pledge themselves to be faithful to the covenant and to declare that they would be susceptible to or subject to or worthy of the penalty of death if they failed to keep their covenant commitments. It was at that point that God put Abram, and you can read the story in Genesis 15, God put Abram in kind of a conscious coma. I don't know exactly what you would call it in our language, but Abram was set over on the side and he couldn't participate, but he could see what was going on. And as Abram watched, he saw a flaming torch and a smoking fire pot walk between those sacrificed animals, the halves. I know it sounds a little gross. It is a little gross, but it's what they did. And he watched this flaming torch and smoking fire pot walk between those animals, and in so doing, declare faithfulness to the covenant relationship. Now, what's going on here? Well, clearly this is God being represented by the flaming torch and smoking fire pot. And most of the scholarship seems to indicate this is one item, not a flaming torch and a smoking fire pot. Sometimes I think maybe God meant for it to be two, but most of the guys who look at the language tell us that it's a flaming torch with a smoking fire pot. Well, does that mean it's one item or could it still be two? I'm curious about that. But either way, it's God walking through what they call the walls of death, making covenant commitments. And in a very real sense, absolutely real, 100% right on, God is, by doing that, taking full responsibility for the covenant, both for His promises and for Abram's promises. Now think about that. Think about the implications of that. God is saying, I will keep my word, and Abram, I'll be responsible for you keeping yours. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, it is no great surprise for us to realize that people, Abram and his descendants, us, you, me, all of us, have not kept our covenant commitments with God. In other words, it's what the Bible says we've all done. We've all sinned. We've all violated the terms of the covenant with God. If you want to know what the terms of the covenant with God are, just think Ten Commandments and the things that God said we're supposed to do and the things that God said we're supposed to not do. That's the covenant commitments we make to each other, to God, and God makes his commitments to us. To Abram, he made a couple of really significant commitments. One is he would give him descendants, including the birth of a son, and he would give him land. And that land is hotly disputed yet today, but God clearly made a covenant that this would be land for Abram and his people forever. And Abram, as part of his responsibility in the covenant, was to keep the law of God, or the Ten Commandments, or as we sometimes summarize it, love God with all you got and your neighbor as yourself. So that's Abraham's responsibility, except that good old Abram, who became Abraham, is sitting over here and not participating, and God is participating in this covenant, saying, Abram, essentially saying to Abram, I know you're going to mess it up, so I'm going to take care of it. Now, what does that have to do with the future? Well, covenant commitments were meant to be kept, or if you violated them, you were subject to death. God even committed himself to that and saying that if I violate the terms of the covenant, I'm subject to death. Now, that's a horror that we can't even imagine what would have been like if God had violated the covenant and subjected himself to death. We can't even go there. He didn't, so we don't have to, and that's good. But the fact that God obligated himself and essentially guaranteed the covenant on Abram's behalf has significant implications. And to me, that's the best explanation for why Jesus had to die. We, Abram, and all the rest of his heirs, have sinned. The Bible tells us that we've sinned. Consequently, we are subject to death because that's the penalty for violating the covenant commitments. But enter Jesus, who was born fully human, fully divine. He did not sin. He lived a perfect life, and he came to step into human history to be a person who now fully qualifies to be the sacrifice for sins. And the Bible says God made him sin for us. So Jesus, by dying, and why did he have to die? He died because the penalty for sin was death, and he took that on so that, as the scriptures say, the righteous requirements of the law could be fulfilled. He took that on himself, and he died so we don't have to. He died so that everybody else could count on his sacrifice for their salvation, for their deliverance from evil, for their being saved from sin. So Jesus didn't die so God could pour out his wrath on him. Jesus stepped into history because God took responsibility for that, because he loved people so much that he always wanted to provide a way for us to be redeemed, for us to escape the penalty of death. So when Jesus went to the cross willingly, when he walked back and met those people who came to arrest him, he was living out what started way back in Genesis at that covenant when God said, I'm going to take care of all of this. And he was faithful to keep his responsibilities, his promises to Abram and to Abram's descendants. And he was responsible for keeping his part, or Abram's part, I should say, of the covenant by Jesus coming and dying so that people didn't have to. And now we can depend upon the sacrifice of Jesus to deliver us from evil. So if you want to know why Jesus had to die, it's because God took covenant responsibility for our sins. That's a pretty big deal, don't you think? That's a very big deal. So Jesus died. Sometimes people will fuss and fume about, did he really die? He died. Roman crucifixion, the whole ordeal, was not intended for anyone to survive. Jesus really did die. He really was buried. But then, come Easter Sunday, what we call Easter Sunday, we discover resurrection. Well, let's go to Mark's gospel and let's read the story of resurrection as Mark tells us that story. And it's in Mark, it's the end of Mark, chapter 16. And you can read that in whatever English translation you find most helpful. I'm going to read from the New Revised Standard Version, updated edition this time. It's just a few verses. We'll talk about that and some of the implications of what it means that Jesus is alive. So Jesus had been buried. They had lived through Saturday, what we call Saturday. They called Sabbath. They had lived through Sabbath, came to what we call Sunday. So verse 1 of chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And that ends verse 8, and it ends what we have clarity as being the ending of the Gospel of Mark. Now, there's a lot of stuff that's being written about it, and if you look at your English translation, you will see, almost certainly, another longer ending. Most scholars don't really believe that that's Mark's ending. They think that was added sometime, but nobody feels real comfortable in explaining exactly what it means. But almost everybody, and you'll never get unanimity on these kind of things, you understand that, but almost everybody agrees that what we have as the longer ending of Mark, which is often called the longer ending of Mark, wasn't really what Mark gave us. He may have had a longer ending, but we don't have it. Why? Nobody knows. Did he really write a longer ending? Nobody is positive. A lot of speculation on that. But what we can do is we can deal with what we have of Mark, and we can remind ourselves that God in his wisdom preserved what he wanted us to have, and so our responsibility is to deal with what God gave us, not so much to think about what is missing or what Mark might have said. So for us, let's just take a look at what we have here. And what we have is a very simple, clear story that these women went to the tomb and Jesus wasn't there. Now they went prepared to do what was common in those days, to take spices to the tomb for obvious reasons. They were prepared to carry out that responsibility, that duty, if you will. They were also very much aware that how would they move the stone, because tombs in those days were covered by stones that would roll downhill into place, and it would have been very unlikely that they could have moved it themselves. But when they got there, that problem had disappeared because the stone was rolled away. And they went in, and there was a man described by Mark as a man. Other gospels describe that person that was in the tomb as an angel. And they get the message that, don't be upset, but he's not here. He's risen. In our words, he's alive, man, he's alive. And he's going to meet you in Galilee. So they get both good news that Jesus is alive, stunning news, how could they ever have believed that news? And they get instructions that he's going to go ahead and meet you in Galilee and tell his disciples and make sure you tell Peter that he's going to meet you there. And they didn't know what to do. So here's what it says they did. They went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, as I said, all we have to deal with is the reality that they were afraid. And what does that mean? It means they were afraid. It says they didn't tell anyone. Now, to be sure, we know that the disciples heard because other gospels explain that. But what's going on with Mark and the ending like this? And what's with the idea of terror and amazement? Well, it's not the first time people have been amazed and terrified by Jesus. And so we can pick up on that little hint to interpret what's going on here and give us some insight. So, for example, in Mark chapter 16, around verse 8, we read the story of a woman who touched Jesus' garment and was healed. And when Jesus realized it, she fell down before him in fear and astonishment and trembling. Same idea as we read here in Mark chapter 16. Well, why was she doing that? Well, she knew she had been healed, and that was good, but she knew that Jesus knew something had happened, and she didn't know what Jesus would do. So when you're in the presence of that kind of power, you would likely be afraid. And she was. She was trembling with fear. We also know that some other incidents happened of people who were trembling with fear in Jesus' presence. For example, Peter said one time, it's recorded in Luke chapter 5, "Go away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." He was afraid. He didn't know what Jesus was going to do, and he wanted him to go away. Isaiah's vision, if you're going to go back to the Old Testament, in Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah saw the vision, he was afraid. He knew he was unclean. What would happen in the midst of the holiness of God? He was afraid. So imagine here, Peter, specifically mentioned, Peter, who had said, "I won't deny the Lord," but did. What would he think now? Jesus is alive. What's he going to do to me now? Because I denied him. Reason for Peter to be concerned. The disciples had all deserted Jesus when he was arrested. And now Jesus says, "Go to Galilee. I'm going to meet you there." Is it any wonder that someone might think that they would be afraid? Uh-oh, everything has changed. What's going to happen to me? Because Jesus is now alive. So you see, this idea of being afraid isn't really far-fetched at all. It's quite understandable. In fact, probably our problem is we aren't afraid in the presence of God enough. We don't have enough awe and astonishment and amazement at God to put us in a respectful attitude that recognizes in the presence of a holy one what's going to happen to us. And so this is not really a shocking occurrence. It's not really an occurrence that we shouldn't expect. It's really quite understandable when you begin to think about that. Now, it's also true that Jesus didn't want people to have that kind of fear in his presence. So we understand that as the story unfolds in other gospels that they did talk to Jesus and they were reconciled to all of that and they didn't have any reason to be afraid. But I wonder sometimes if our hesitation to embrace Jesus comes from this idea of being afraid of, what's going to happen to us? What's involved in following Jesus? And do I really want that? That's well illustrated by a story that a man named Paul Harvey told many years ago. He told it every year just prior to Easter. And I remember hearing it, and it has enlivened, enriched, a lot of words, my Easter ever since. And I have frequently used it. And I want to tell you that story. It's the story of a Boston preacher who went to his church on a marvelous Easter Sunday morning. There was still a bit of a chill in the air, but spring was springing. And he went to his fine New England-style church, walked into the sanctuary as the service was beginning to take his place on the platform. And as he walked in, he was carrying a bent-up, beat-up, rusted old birdcage. And he sat that beat-up, bent-up, rusted old birdcage right down on the platform next to the pulpit and went and sat down in his place. The service proceeded. And when it became his time to preach, he got up and began to tell this story. He talked about how he had been out that week on a walk. After all, it was spring. It was beginning to warm up and be more decent weather. And so he went for a walk, and as he was on that walk, he met a young boy of about 10 years old. And he saw the boy coming, and he noticed that the boy was swinging a bird cage, When they got close enough, the preacher noticed that there were several birds huddling on the floor of that birdcage, shivering, as it were, from probably fright, maybe from cold. Well, the compassionate preacher got the boy's attention, and he asked the boy, "Well, I see you have birds there. Where did you get the birds?" And the boy responded, "Well, I trapped them. They're my birds." Well, the pastor understood that. The preacher got that idea. He wasn't concerned about that, but he didn't think he ought to ask the boy what he was going to do with those birds. And the boy said, well, he thought for a minute. Finally, he said, "I'm going to have fun with them." Well, boys typically do have fun with things, and so that wasn't really a surprise to the preacher either. The boy went on to say, "I'm going to play with them. I'm just going to have fun with them." Well, what more would you expect from a 10-year-old boy? And the preacher didn't expect much more, but he did go on to say to the boy, "Well, sooner or later, you're going to get tired of them. What are you going to do with them then?" Well, the boy hadn't thought about ever getting tired of things. You would expect that of a boy, and so he didn't quite know what to think, so he thought for a minute, and finally he said, "I'm going to feed them to my cats. I have cats at home. My cats like birds. I'm going to feed them to my cats." Well, that got the preacher's attention big time, and so he said to the boy, "Well, son, how much would you like for your birds?" Well, now the boy was really surprised and taken off his game, and he hesitated, and he said, "Well, mister, these are my birds, but you don't want these birds. These are just plain old ugly field birds, and you don't want these birds. They can't sing. They can't do anything. They're ugly. You don't want these birds." The minister persisted, and the boy thought, and he thought, I've got one here. He had no idea he could make money off these birds, but he hesitated, and he thought, and he didn't want them to get away, so he didn't want to ask for too much or too little. And finally, he said to the preacher, $2. Well, the preacher reached into his pocket and pulled out two $1 bills and gave it to the boy, and the boy, he snatched those two $1 bills and took off faster than you might have expected, but likely because he didn't want the preacher to change his mind and not buy the birds. Well, the preacher took the cage that the boy had left, and he went over to a little bit of a sheltered place there on his walk and watched as the boy disappeared. And he knelt down and he opened the door of the cage and started tapping on the one side of the rusty exterior of the cage to encourage the little birds to fly out. And one by one, they hopped out and, sure enough, flew away. Well, now the preacher had accounted for the empty cage in his fine Boston church. But now he went on to tell what at first seemed like a totally separate story about how the time Jesus had been out for a walk across the universe and he encountered the devil. And he stopped the devil and he asked the devil what he had been up to. Well, Satan was quick to boast. He said, "I set a trap in Eden's garden and I caught myself a world full of people. I've got a world of people, Jesus." Oh, Jesus said, "You trapped a world full of people. Well, what are you going to do with all those people you've trapped?" Well, the devil said, "Well, I'm going to play with them. I'm going to tease them. I'm going to make them marry and divorce. I'm going to make them fight and kill each other. I'm going to teach them to throw bombs at each other. I'm going to have so much fun with them, Jesus." Oh, Jesus thought for a minute and said, "Well, you know, you can't have fun with them forever. When you get tired of all of that, what will you do with them then?" At that moment, Satan stopped, right dead in his tracks. With the blackest, coldest eyes you or I could imagine, he looked at Jesus, and he said to him, "I'm going to kill them. I'm going to send them straight to hell." Jesus looked back with a totally different countenance, and he said to Satan, "How much do you want for that world full of people?" "Oh," Satan said, "you can't be serious. You don't want these people. These are no good people. They'll spit on you. They'll hate you. They'll hit you. They'll beat you. They'll pull out your hair. Jesus, they'll hammer nails in you. You don't want these people. They're no good." Jesus looked back, persisted, and said, "How much?" And if Satan's eyes could have gotten any blacker or colder, or if his countenance could have been any more resolute, he looked at Jesus and he said, all of your tears, all of your sweat, and all of your blood. That's the price. And Jesus paid the price, took the cage, and opened the door. In a very real way, that's the story of Easter, that the door is open for you, for me, for everyone. The really curious thing is that so many people are afraid to walk through that door. They'd rather stay in their anger or in their bitterness or in their hatred for their neighbor or their unforgiveness. Or maybe they'd rather stay trapped in their addictive behaviors. They just don't want to walk through that door because they're afraid. What does it mean to encounter a holy God? Well, what it means to encounter a holy God is to come face to face with a love that we can scarcely imagine, with a love that walked toward the cross on that hillside of Mount of Olives, and that embraced the cross despising the shame, that took covenant responsibility for our sins, and unquestionably paid a price that sets us free. The question today is, do you have the courage to walk through the door and be free? I'm Pastor Rick.